Welcome to the Goth Librarian Podcast, an audio collection of the dark, the dreary, and the downright disturbing. With the passing of time, places that were once out in full view are now obscured by symbols of modernity. These hidden places either evolved into something else entirely or were built over with brand new structures. And sometimes these secret spots stand right in front of tourists' noses, but their histories have been long forgotten. Only local historians and curiosity seekers uncover the mysterious past held in the underbelly of popular cities. Present-day residents and the average tourist often have no idea what shadows of yesteryear swirl all around them. But I did the digging for you, listener. Stick around for a journey sure to pique your curiosity. Here is my list of the top 5 best-kept secrets of popular cities. Number 5. A Victorian-era subway station resembling a crypt lies silently below a busy London road. The Great Exhibition of 1851 showcased international innovation, drawing a crowd of 6 million. It was housed in the Crystal Palace, a behemoth iron structure that featured glass dome ceilings. 2 railway stations were built specifically to make the event more accessible to both exhibitors and spectators. The high-level and low-level subway stations dropped off passengers near the Hyde Park Exhibition Hall. The high-level station was for first-class passengers, with ornate arches made of brick and stone approaching a glass-domed corridor toward the building. The low-level line, for the lower classes, supposedly required passengers to walk uphill 500 yards. High-level station opened across from the Crystal Palace in August of 1865. Its distinct octagonal pillars and red and cream-colored walls resemble a crypt, and for good reason. It is rumored to have been designed and built by Italian architects who were cathedral craftsmen by trade. Historians argue there are no records backing up this claim. A fire destroyed the Crystal Palace in 1936. This led to a sharp decline in traffic until the station was made obsolete by newer tube lines. During World War II, the empty husk of Highline Station was used as an air raid shelter. Once the war ended, children would play around its remains, and local teenagers used the space for motor racing. In the 1990s, ravers partied there, and the band The Chemical Brothers used it as a set for their Setting Sun music video. A group known as the Friends of Crystal Palace Subway has fought for restoration and public access. Due to their efforts, a gate was installed that prevents vandalism, and thousands of visitors a year bear witness to a relic of Victorian history during events like the Crystal Palace Festival and Heritage Open Weekend. Number 4. New York's Grand Central Station is radioactive. New York City's Grand Central Terminal is one of the top 10 most visited tourist attractions in the world. It attracts an average of 21 million visitors annually. And with its grandiose columns, dome ceilings, and brass embellishments, it's not hard to see why it draws such a crowd. It currently serves a practical purpose. Over 260,000 passengers a day rely on the transportation hub. But its bizarre past remains unknown to most travelers passing through. Originally built in 1871, the version we know today is actually the third edition. A ban was placed on steam engines operating below 42nd Street in 1854. This was a result of resident complaints about the noise and pollution. Grand Central Depot was the solution. Until it wasn't. The depot incorporated service from the Hudson, New Haven, and Harlem Railroads. Each had its own waiting room. Over time, these rail lines drew a larger crowd than the first structure could support. 30 years later, a second, more expanded station was built. It was twice the size of the original depot, but still inefficient. In 1903, several major architecture firms competed to design a railroad hub that would align with 20th century needs. And, at this point in New York history, 42nd Street was much more lively, packed with nightlife, theatrical grandeur, and upscale dining. It was time for Grand Central Station to be both functional and aesthetically dazzling. And it was. There was even a red carpet if you were traveling aboard the 20th Century Limited. This train line advertised itself as the most famous train in the world. The direct line from New York City's Grand Central Station to Chicago's LaSalle Street Station was associated with the upper class. Railroad workers would unfurl a crimson carpet every afternoon to direct passengers onto the train. In fact, it is believed the term red carpet was first used in reference to this practice. Train travel from the early 1900s through the 1940s was meant to be a lavish event, at least for the wealthy. Luxury trains were equipped with a dining car and spacious passenger cabins. There were even bellhops that would carry luggage from the ticketing booth to the train. But then the airline industry killed it for train travel. Though numbers have dwindled substantially since its heyday, Grand Central Terminal is still used heavily by commuters and New England visitors. So what is the biggest secret hiding within its walls? Well, radiation, actually. Granite was the main material used to construct the iconic station. Though most natural materials contain radioactive elements, granite boasts higher levels of radiation than most. So while visitors are gazing up at its arches, they are unknowingly exposing themselves to uranium. But not to worry. Just passing through will expose you to trace amounts. As for employees, it's debatable. Some sources say if Grand Central were a nuclear power plant, it would be shut down for exceeding the maximum annual dose for employees. Then again, according to PBS, we're all exposed to radiation on a daily basis. One last fact, the U.S. Capitol building in Washington, D.C., is said to have even higher levels of radiation, enough to make it another Chernobyl situation if a nuclear reactor was built on site. Yikes. Number 3. Social outcasts had their own graveyard in South London. London's very first red light district was in Southwark. This neighborhood of mixed reputation sprouted up during the late medieval period, around the year 1066. By the Tudor period, the public bathhouses had morphed into brothels. The southern London borough is nestled just beyond London's city limits. This was key in the 12th century because debauchery in Southwark was unrestricted by city ordinances. Southwark was a dizzying array of boisterous taverns, raunchy theatrical productions, lively brothels, and other forms of public spectacle. Bear baiting was a popular form of entertainment. This involved several dogs, usually gigantic English mastiffs, lunging after and attacking a chained bear. It's safe to say PETA would not be on board with that. Surprisingly, this practice wasn't outlawed until 1835. So who governed the area, if not the city itself? The crown, until 1161, when Henry II gave the reins over to the Diocese of Winchester. The Bishop of Winchester had the power to sell licenses to brothel keepers. So while the Church of England strongly opposed the lascivious acts contained within brothel walls, they were happy to profit greatly from all that sin. At the time Henry II set these ordinances, there were 18 licensed brothels. They employed over 1,000 prostitutes. These sex workers were referred to as Winchester geese, possibly coined from the practice of workers bearing their pale cleavage to attract clients. Henry II's ordinances were meant to protect the women employed by brothels. Workers could not borrow large sums of money from their employers. This helped curtail enslavement or imprisonment to pay off debt. Among the 39 rules established, there were quite a few that may have been more beneficial to the church. This included the closure of brothels on religious holidays, nuns and married women being barred from working in brothels, and strict rules against foul language. One of the more serious offenses, taking a lover for free, was punishable by a fine of 6 shillings and 8 pence, 3 weeks of imprisonment, banishment from Southwark, and one mortifying public punishment, the cucking stool. Essentially, being tied to a wooden stool and then dipped repeatedly into raw sewage. Worst carnival dunking tank ever. Christian doctrine meant prostitutes, even those living outside the city of London, could not be buried in consecrated ground. A separate cemetery, known as Crossbones Burial Ground, was established in Southwark at an unknown date. The earliest reference made about the cemetery was in 1598. That year, Tudor historian John Stowe wrote in his Survey of London, "I have heard of ancient men of good credit report that these single women were forbidden the rites of the church so long as they continued that sinful life and were excluded from Christian burial if they were not reconciled before their death. And therefore, there was a plot of ground called the Single Woman's Churchyard appointed for them far from the parish church." The brothels closed in the 17th century, though Southwark's reputation didn't see much improvement. By the Victorian era, it was considered one of the worst slums in the London region. The South Bankside neighborhoods were swarming with violent crime, and police even dreaded having to go there. In 1854, London's infamous cholera outbreak decimated large numbers of the population. Southwark was one of the hardest hit areas. As most of its residents were destitute, Crossbones was repurposed into a pauper's graveyard. Sadly, this made it a favorite spot for body snatchers. In 1853, public complaint led to the closing of Crossbones. The first wave of cholera swept across the city that year, and its cause remained undetermined. Some believed the abundant number of decaying corpses released disease-carrying particles into the air. The true cause, a contaminated water supply, wasn't determined until 1854. The coffins and crossbones were stacked up so high, the freshest burial would often rest just 2 feet from the surface. The Disused Burial Grounds Act of 1854 made it illegal to sell the land, so Crossbones sat untouched and largely forgotten, though at one point it might have functioned as a fairground. In the 1990s, the London Underground began work on the Jubilee Line extension. Their project involved digging underground in Southwark. The Museum of London knew some history of the old burial ground and seized the opportunity to do a deep dive into ancient history. After getting permission from the city, archaeologists performed a 6-week dig. They turned up 148 skeletons dating back to the early 1800s. More than half were young children, reflective of the era's high infant mortality rate. Deformed, scarred, and eroded bones indicate that many fell victim to diseases like smallpox, tuberculosis, rickets, scurvy, and syphilis. This sampling was less than 1% of the 15,000 bodies estimated to be buried there. In 1996, the Friends of Crossbones was formed. They are essentially a group of advocates working to honor the long-buried dead there. A 20-year campaign to get a permanent memorial garden on the lot proved successful. It opened to the public in 2018. Every Halloween, a ritual is performed to commemorate the outcast dead. Songs and poems are read from John Constable's drama, The Southwark Mysteries. Then candles are lit to guide a procession toward the red iron gates in Red Cross Way. To close the ritual, the names of the dead are read aloud while ribbons are tied to the gate. The result is an eye-catching, colorful shrine. Visitors contribute more ribbon, mementos, and flowers year-round. In 2004, the Southwark Council approved and funded the memorial plaque now mounted to the gates. The plaque, which features a goose, reads, "Crossbones Graveyard. In medieval times, this was an unconsecrated graveyard for prostitutes or Winchester geese. By the 18th century, it had become a pauper's burial ground, which closed in 1853. Here, local people have created a memorial shrine, the Outcast Dead, RIP. Maybe, at last, these marginalized, shunned individuals are getting the acknowledgement and respect they so long deserved. Number two, entire ships are buried under San Francisco. As you learned in my last episode, the California Gold Rush was kind of a big deal. While many hopeful prospectors arrived by train or wagon, a fair number traveled from distant shores by ship. One ship, the Niantic, was one of the first whaling vessels to transport gold seekers to San Francisco. It was originally constructed for the trade route to China. But there was too much money to be made off of Gold Rush hopefuls. So, in 1849, the Niantic sailed to the Bay Area from Panama with 246 passengers. The journey spanned from May to July. Upon arrival, many of the crew abandoned their post to join the hunt for gold. The first day of docking, 5 crew members left. The second day, 9 more left, and 2 additional men abandoned their post on the third day. It is rumored that the last pair of men stabbed the captain to death before fleeing. With not enough remaining crew to operate the ship for the journey home, the Niantic's owners were forced to sell it. The new buyers docked the vessel and repurposed it. Its many variations included offices, a warehouse, a saloon, and lastly, a store. In 1851, a sequence of 7 fires broke out in San Francisco. It burned the Niantic down to the waterline. During the city's reconstruction, the Niantic, along with other repurposed ships, were buried under landfill. Future versions of the Niantic paint an ominous picture. The Niantic Hotel was built on the site and then also burned down in 1872. The next structure was the Niantic Building. It collapsed during the 1906 earthquake. I'd imagine, after all that, architects all over the city simultaneously threw their arms up and ranted, well, we tried. The height of the gold rush brought up to 1,000 unmoored ships, all of which docked in San Francisco Bay. Even if the crew didn't get hit with gold fever and quit upon docking, other sailing vessels were in such poor condition that the journey to the land of gold was its final destination. Ships that weren't in good enough condition to be converted into temporary structures were scrapped of salvageable parts. These materials were then used to build permanent structures. Yup, many of San Francisco's current buildings came from ship corpses. Charming. In 1978, an excavation led to the discovery of the Niantic's hull. Artifacts recovered from the ship can be viewed at the San Francisco Maritime Museum. They include an oil painting, a duck-shaped letter opener, and the ship's slightly charred stern. In case that makes you feel like celebrating, they also found several bottles of Gold Rush-era champagne. The Niantic is one of an estimated 50 ships resting below San Francisco's Financial District and the Embarcadero. Parts of buried ships are still being uncovered, usually during major construction projects. In 1994, workers digging for a light rail tunnel struck the edge of a ship called Rome. The vessel was so gigantic that they had no choice but to tunnel through. So while you're waiting for a boat out to tour Alcatraz Island, think about all the phantom ships buried deep beneath the city, just waiting to be found. Number 1. Los Angeles has a network of secret underground tunnels that were once used to hide bodies. In downtown LA, a subterranean labyrinth of passageways spanning 11 miles rests below the busy streets. Most residents of the City of Angels have no knowledge of their existence. Currently, they are a concrete graveyard with crumbling walls, colorful graffiti, and a checkered past that may never be fully understood. There are many stories about how these tunnels were used. It's generally agreed by curiosity seekers and urban explorers that they have existed since the early 20th century. Downtown LA's golden age was the 1920s, just in time for Prohibition. The underground tunnels were a convenient way to transport bootlegged liquor beyond the glaring eyes of the law. King Eddie's Saloon, once a favorite haunt of boastful womanizer Charles Bukowski, has persisted for over a century. During Prohibition, it was a high-end saloon for guests of the then-lavish King Edward Hotel. The owners opened a speakeasy in its basement, which is adjacent to the tunnels. Because of the creepiness factor, many paranormal fanatics feel it is haunted. Tales still persist that an inebriated woman shows up just before closing to ask male customers for a ride home. The tunnels also extend under Bunker Hill, where government buildings tower above at street level. This makes them ideal for transporting high-profile criminals stealthily between the federal courthouse and the Hall of Justice. One such criminal was LA's notorious crime boss, Mickey Cohen, who is convicted for income tax evasion. It is said that mobsters use these tunnels to stow bodies, which isn't a big stretch of the imagination, especially with Cohen's ties to the Italian mafia. When faced with an overcrowded morgue, coroners may have also kept surplus bodies down there. And when Charles Manson went to trial in June of 1970, some of his fanatics supposedly conspired to free him by using these tunnels as an escape route. Nothing came of it, if there ever was such a plot. But the site is also tied to a wild urban legend. In 1933, mining engineer G. Warren Schufelt started digging in the middle of the city. He was searching for a lost underground city populated by an advanced race of beings known as lizard people. Yes, I'm serious. Based on a Hopi legend he heard, he hoped to locate a key room where records of the subterranean lizard city were written on tablets of gold. Astonishingly, he never found any of that, and no one else has looked. So these tunnels must have been constructed with a purpose in mind, right? They once housed what would have been the world's most extensive interurban railroad system. And it would have been LA's first underground transportation network. Instead, the costly project was abandoned and freeways became the predominant way of getting around the city. Today, the tunnels are occasionally still used by Hollywood directors seeking a set that resembles a post-apocalyptic wasteland. Runners also sometimes train down there on a rainy day. And while they are officially closed to the public, they are still accessible, at your own risk. An old elevator hidden behind the Hall of Records on Temple Street will take you down to the tunnels. Among the graffiti, you'll see rusted machinery, iron gates that block off areas that aren't earthquake safe, and maybe you'll even spot the Lizard King himself. Does your city have any secrets? Email me at thegothlibrarianpodcast@gmail.com and tell me your story.
Like what you hear? Follow me on Twitter @gothpodcast and Instagram @that_gothlibrarian. Thank you for listening.